Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2019. Lecture 11, delivered on February 25, 2019. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates.
Today, interest rates. And I begin this by talking about something that seems like it's something else, but it actually is about interest rates. And so I would start this with a question for you, ma'am. What is money?
Physically, or like the cost?
What is money?
Money is what we put value towards and
put value.
Exchange.
Okay. It's almost like you're remembering something from an economics class, kind of. What's money?
Something that we use to buy things.
Well, yeah, that's true. You're right about that. Sir, what's money?
Money is a form of currency we use to buy things.
Form of currency. You just said money is a kind of, is a form of money. Currency is money. But we're working on it. Well, of course. I mean, and a cookie, and a pat on the left shoulder. What are those? Oh, no, those are coconut. God. It's not the taste, it's the consistency. You guys didn't watch Zombieland. Okay. There it is. But you're still eating coconut. Okay. Let me think. Madam. You and I live in the Pleistocene. Now, that was a very long time ago. They had weapons, and they had fire, and they had some semblance of culture, but it was mostly, there was certainly no dollar, paper dollar bills or anything like that around. But you are a hunter. Now, you are out there on these vast savannas that were covering Europe and Great Britain. They were kind of connected at that time during the Ice Age. And you go and you kill a moose. And you take that moose and you throw it over your shoulders. You're a Pleistocene person, you know, you can do those kind of things. And you come walking up to my cave. Now, my cave is kind of well known because in my cave, I bake apple pies. In fact, it's Al's Apple Pie Cave. Okay? And so you come up there and you knock on the rock, clock, clock, clock. And I come, yes? And you show me your moose. Okay? So we're going to make a deal. Now, you love my apple pies. And I love moose. And so we make a deal that you're going to trade me one moose for two of my big-ass apple pies. As a matter of fact, this is my special, Al's Big-Ass Cave Apple Pies. Okay. So you go out and kill another moose, and you go over to this gentleman's cave. Now, this gentleman actually makes very, very nice saber-toothed tiger necklaces. And you trade the moose for four of his saber-toothed tiger necklaces. Now, these are going to be valuable because he gets to go out and get these saber-toothed tigers, and sooner or later, one of them is going to say no. They don't believe him anymore about his saber-toothed tiger dental service. You just take them out so you can make necklaces, so for a moose. You go to another cave with another moose, and at this cave, you have shiny, shiny metallic objects that when you turn them just right. They can catch from the sun, they can catch grass on fire, dry grass. And so you trade a moose for 10 of his. Now, that moose is money. And here's why. Money is anything that is generally accepted in exchange for something else. Money is anything that is generally accepted in exchange for something else. Money, in that sense, seems to be physical, but you can think of ways, things that are money that have no physicality to them. You, madam, are a very popular person. So you can trade liking someone on Facebook for some stuff. You like him, and so he'll send you a couple of dollars. You like her, and she'll send you some cream puffs. So in that sense, because it's generally accepted in exchange, it's not even physical, but it still follows the definition that it is generally accepted in exchange for something else of value. So that's where we start with the idea of money, is that it is not what we might consider in our time. When I taught this, and I've taught economics and finance and math and English and all that for almost 40 years, when I was teaching about money, even 10 years ago, I said there are three kinds of money. And only in the last year and a half to 2 years have I had to open and say there are four kinds of money. The first one is what you might consider to be the most primitive. It's called barter money. Barter money is physical. Barter money is physical. It's characterized by something very important. Two very important factors drive money, its characteristics. One is its liquidity. This is low liquidity. Now, here's a definition of liquidity. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted into another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be converted into another asset. Follow me on this, because if you try to go to one of these failure sites on the web, they'll give you a slightly different definition, which is actually a disaster. And I will, on the exam, find out if you have learned the right definition or if you went to the web for the easy, wrong definition. First of all, efficiency. In other words, with the lowest transactions cost and the quickest turnaround. That is liquidity. Extremely low transactions cost, extremely fast turnaround. So barter money is not liquid. It is highly illiquid. It is very difficult to turn that moose into an apple pie. It is very difficult to turn other barter objects into something else. Cash is highly liquid because you can instantly, almost without transaction costs, turn it into something else. And I'm going to give you very quickly what you're going to see on the web. Liquidity is the ease with which an asset can be turned into cash. That is fundamentally wrong, because cash is an asset. You're looping the definition doing that. And ease is irrelevant. That has no technical meaning. So barter money has low liquidity, but it has something that is very high. High intrinsic value. it actually can be used. Barter money can be used. You don't have to trade it. You can use it. You, madam, could eat that moose, but you could also trade it. You would eat almost every bit of that moose, except for the horns, and you can hang those, you know, in your dining parlor in your cave. But you see, it has extraordinarily high, almost perfect, not maybe not perfect, but almost perfect intrinsic value. It is valuable in and of itself, not just in transactions. Now, the next one has a couple of different names. Sometimes you'll see it called commodity money. Sometimes you'll see it called metal money. Gold, silver, platinum, copper. Now, this is the one that's in the middle. It has some degree of liquidity. It might be very, very liquid, or it might not be. I mean, you see, if you were to pay me for that apple pie, and you say, here is a yellow stone, it's gold, I might believe you or I might not. More than likely, I'd have some way to test it. Might be as simple as biting on it, because gold is soft. But there would not be that immediate, instant liquidity. It would have some chain of verification that would have to be involved in it. Diamonds are the same way. I mean, a diamond, you can bluff someone for a while with a zircon. It's not even a real diamond. But even once you've determined that it's a real diamond, diamonds have so many different grades, and it takes some money to actually verify the quality of a diamond. Similarly, if you go to one of those gold exchange stores, you are not going to get the current price of gold on the spot market. They're going to take money from you as transactions cost. That's how they'll make their money. Now, the other interesting thing is that metal money has intermediate intrinsic value. And you see, you can use gold to exchange, but you can also use gold for other things. Gold is used in circuit boards. Gold is used in jewelry and statues. So in other words, you can do something with it other than just trade it. Interestingly, when we go to ancient battlefields, and we, from the very ancient times or even into the Middle Ages, we'll find these arrowheads, spearheads, and if you look at them very closely, they'll have odd engravings on them. Oh, this was a coin that they hammered into this for the battle. So in other words, it served as a coin at one point. It was intended to be a coin, but it could also, with some effort, opportunity cost, be turned into something that could be usable in and of itself. Okay, now the third one, which used to be the last one. Now, the correct pronunciation of this is fiat, but you'll hear pronounced fiat by pseudo-intellectuals. Fiat money. Fiat money has high liquidity, and it has almost, and that's important, almost no intrinsic value.
Okay.
almost no intrinsic value whatsoever. You see, fiat money is money only by decree of a sovereign. Fiat money is money only by decree of a sovereign. It wouldn't be money except for the fact that the government orders this to be accepted as money. This is fiat money. Technically, I mean, there's linen in here. You could use it sort of, kind of, for something or other. Toilet paper, I don't know. So it doesn't have zero intrinsic value. It does have something. I can make a paper airplane out of it. It's not much at all. But it's important to note that it has a little tiny bit. Now, interestingly enough, long before your time, in my time when I was a kid, these actually, right now they say Federal Reserve Note, and I'll explain that in a couple of lectures what that means. But they used to be, say, silver certificate, because they could be exchanged for silver. How? Because quarters were made of silver back then. So 4 quarters was equivalent to a dollar, so you could convert this into silver. That means that in that time, it was actually kind of a commodity money. It was actually a kind of commodity money because it was technically exchangeable immediately. You just go to a bank and you could get silver for it. So in that time, we had commodity money, and then they stopped making money with valuable metals and started making them with cheap pot metals, and they took the silver certificate off it because it could no longer be exchanged for silver directly. Unless you wanted to pay a very big transactions cost, you could probably get 20 cents worth of silver for a dollar, something like that. Okay, that's fiat money. It has almost no intrinsic value in and of itself. However, it is widely used. Most people think that's money. Well, that's a kind of money. Finally, now we come to the one for your time, which there were technically attempts at this in the 1990s, early 1990s. There was an attempt at this, but it went away because it was just before its time. And the technology at that time wasn't able to accommodate what would be needed for this. What I'm talking about is cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ethereum, you name it. These have perfect liquidity. It's perfect if you know how to do it. And they have no intrinsic value. They don't even exist as a physical object. They are purely an object of electrons. And like I said, there was an attempt at crypto. Apple tried to do one in the early 1990s. They called it Apple Wallet, I think. But the problem was that the mathematical and computer infrastructure needed for it just didn't exist, except sort of a version by Apple, a primitive version. And no one trusted this. What? They wanted something in their hands, a currency that doesn't ever exist in real life. That was the thing, is that the cryptos needed all of these complex things like the blockchain and understanding of how blockchains work and the application of them to construct Merkle trees and all that kind of stuff. And I will do a quick little review of blockchains so that you don't get it from the wrong. I understand the accounting people are trying to teach a little bit about blockchains, and they're at 131, 132. Is that right? Did they try to mention them? They didn't? I heard a couple of people say that their classes, they did. The idea, well, blockchain is nothing but a ledger. No, it's not. That's like saying a human being is a meat sack. But anyway. Okay. Oh, well, cryptocurrency will replace the other currencies? No, it won't. Look, these all exist. One kind of dominates in any given era. So once commodity monies began to show up, barter money didn't go away. It just got joined by a fairly popular. But for a very long time, commodity monies, the idea that everyone walked around with coins in their pocket, that's a myth. Almost, well, very few people of other than nobility and craftsmen and things like that had coins, had commodity money. Until more recent times, that's a kind of a myth that everyone had coins. You did. You could get your hands on them. You could steal them, or you might be able to trade. But for most people, their lives were so desperate that I don't want money. I want some food. I'll do work for you, but give me some damn food to eat. And then when the fiat monies came along, well, that didn't make. Oh, well, now that we have dollar bills, there's no such thing as gold and gold bars and gold bullion. Oh, of course there is. And now that cryptocurrencies are going to come along, that'll make fiat monies obsolete. No, it won't. They'll still be around. They'll probably still be dominant. The cryptos will be used by some people for certain types of transactions, but fiat will be very popular for centuries to come, as will commodity. And you all do barter money. You all do things. Something of value for something of value where there's no money in currency involved. So anyway, there are the types of money. What underlies them all, aside from the two characteristics in various balances, is the fact that they all follow the laws of supply and the law of supply and the law of demand. By the way, there's no such thing as a law of supply and demand. So if anyone ever said, well, that's just a law of supply and demand, you tell them that's a lie. There is no law of supply and demand. But there is a law of supply, and there's a law of demand. And these currencies all obey those laws. There's no safe harbor from the rock-hard rules of economics. So in other words, if lots of people are coming to my cave offering moose, I would no longer have to offer two pies for a moose. I could offer one pie for a moose. Because if you say no, there's a line of people holding moose to offer to me, you see. So there we go. The law of supply. Supply goes up, price goes down. The exchange rate goes down. Similarly, if no one wants a moose, people find out that moose, and this is something you probably didn't know, sir, moose is very high in cholesterol. It's a big, have you ever seen a moose?
Yeah,
I was
from Canada.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was in Canada, and I didn't know my Uncle Howard. He shot himself because he was sitting there clacking horns together, thinking he could get some moose to come. He didn't realize they were sitting right behind him staring at him. What the hell are you doing? And so he got so excited, he blasted his thigh with his gun. Anyway, try to stay on topic. What the hell was I going on about? Oh, demand. If no one wants moose anymore, then if it becomes not so popular, then you know, you're going to have to offer a moose for maybe half a pie because I really don't like moose anymore. It's bad. I've got high cholesterol anyway. It's a little high. And it's also bad. Moose gives me flatulence, okay? Really. And there's nothing in the world worse than a moose fart. Now, moving along. Okay. There's also another thing. Whenever there is an economic object, it is going to have a price. More accurately, most things that there are some things in this world we say its price is, but what we really mean is its rental rate. So, for example, you work at a job, sir, and you get a wage, $8 an hour for you. $8, okay? That's a rental rate on you. You're not selling yourself for $8 an hour. You're renting yourself. So, and that's true of any time you work. They are not buying you. They are renting you. Interestingly enough, even in societies where there is slavery, I bought the slave. Actually, the economics behind it is they're renting with a continuing option to renew. And that option to renew turns rather odd under certain economic pressures, as it did in our country. Essentially, the economy of the South got wrecked because the rental rate was actually going staggeringly high. After more enlightened nations started banning the transport. But the idea here is that everything has a price or a rental rate. Everything does. You, madam, might be willing to be my friend on Facebook. And you're saying, like, hell I would. But you see, there's an opportunity cost to that because then you have to attend to my stupid posts showing my pretty pictures and all that. You're actually burning time by doing that. Money has a rental rate. Money has a rental rate. Now, if there's lots and lots of money, whatever kind of money it is, that rental rate will be low. If there isn't a lot of money, that rental rate will be very high, will be high. Just like here on campus, when we have tons and tons of housing available, the rental rate tends to be fairly low. But as more and more, as fewer and fewer apartments are available, the rental rate goes up. Similarly, as more and more people want to rent, then the rental rate goes up. If a lot of people decide I'm not going to rent, I'm just going to live in the dorms, then the rental rate on properties go down. So money has a rental rate. That rental rate is actually something we call the interest rate. That is the rental rate for money. Now, there are actually several different, as a matter of fact, there are hundreds of interest rates. And that's something in this chapter in the textbook and in these lectures, you're going to learn about all these different kinds of interest rates, what drives, what makes two interest rates different. The factors are actually, some of them are pretty obvious. Some of them are not very well understood. So for example, well, let me start with this. At the base, madam, would you lend me $100 for a year and I'll pay you back $100 in a year? Sure. Well, wait, what's your major? Yep. No, you would not, because you are giving up your own use of that money for a year by doing that. So you're going to have to be rewarded. Why would you give up $100 for a year if you could do something with that money in the time in the interim? You could buy cheeseburgers. You could invest in stocks. I mean, you could go to a casino and roll the dice with that $100. You could buy weed. No, you couldn't. Don't do that. Well, I'll edit that thing. The bottom line is that there is an opportunity cost to giving up consumption. That's the interest rate. That's what it is. The opportunity cost of foregone consumption. But that's a very basic interest rate. It's like what you probably in high school or in some college class learned about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. At the very bottom, you have these animal needs. You have this need for food, for reproduction activity, which I will not. And also, possibly, according to Marxist theory, you also have a fundamental human need for work as well. But one way or the other, there are these foundational needs. So there's some kind of rock bottom rental rate. No interest rate would be below that. It is sort of like the base of all interest rates. We actually have a name for that thing. It's called, and I'll get to that a little later, it's called the risk-free rate. But it works like this. Okay. However, here's the driver. And most textbooks avoid this like the plague. It's an extended discussion of the macroeconomic impact on interest rates of our central bank, the Federal Reserve, and the relationship of our currency to all of the other currencies of the world, and what that can do in some circumstances. You see, if the interest rates in the United States are very high, that means our dollars are very powerful things. Other countries in that situation would really like to have American dollars because then they could invest them here and get very strong returns on their investment. Let me go through that one more time just to make sure I set it up right in your minds. If American interest rates are very high, we say the dollar is strong relative to other currencies. That means other countries want to get our American dollars so they can invest them back here and get those high interest rates. How would they do that? They would do that by selling us their stuff cheap. That way, we would import their goods and export to them our very strong dollars, which they then would have in their foreign reserves to invest back here. That was what China did for years and years and years. They actually cheated at it terribly. The Japanese did it for years and years and years. They didn't cheat. And a lot of other countries, they will sell us their stuff at a low price. In other words, they'll keep their currency weak relative to the dollar so that we will buy their stuff cheap. And in the process, we will send them American dollars in exchange for their cheap toasters and cars. They then have those in their central bank, which they can then bring back here to invest in our stuff. So, in other words, in the case of China, we turned a blind eye to how artificially low their currency, the yuan, was against the American dollar. We just let it happen. Because that made Chinese goods here ludicrously cheap, much cheaper than they should have been. And what that did was, when we bought that stuff, that Chinese stuff, we exported to their central banks American dollars. And why would we want that to happen? because they could not spend the American dollars anywhere but in the United States. So what they did, the Chinese did, and they do to this day, is they buy our treasury debt. When we have to borrow money because we will not align our taxes and spending, we're that irresponsible. When we can't do it ourselves, the Chinese have literally trillions of American dollars. They can come in here and lend us the money we need to keep living beyond our means, year after year, decade after decade. And in exchange, all we have to do is keep our eyes shut to what the Chinese do. And also keep our eyes shut to the fact that the Chinese basically own us. We are their bitches. And that's just the reality of it. That's what interest rates are all about. It is extraordinarily important in human lives and our lives, but hardly anyone understands the dynamics. It's not that hard, and we're just going to keep going through this until it sinks into you and you're very comfortable with it. So, yeah. Let me, okay. You and I are bros. We're such bros that we had ourselves sewn together. Okay, you're going to teach me a lesson. Our heads are together like this.
Sure.
Okay, really? I cleaned myself this morning. Okay, now you're mad at me. I want you to hold it. Take this gun. Take this gun, hold it up to your head. Now, kill me. Shoot me right through your head, right here.
So, okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the Chinese are going to teach us a lesson. Here's an old story. Two missionaries were going to be, they were captured by cannibals. The first missionary is dragged out, and they yell, "We're going to cook you in a pot, and we're going to eat you, and we're going to make your skin into a canoe." And sure enough, they did it. They went back for the other missionary. He's sitting there with a fork, stabbing himself. You know what he was saying? Ain't no one going to make a canoe out of me. Chinese aren't going to do anything like that. Think they would collapse the People's Bank of China because the vast majority of its asset base is foreign reserve of American dollars. They're not going to do that because as soon as they dump those treasuries, as soon as they dump those American dollars, what do you suppose would happen to the value of an American dollar? It would like that. They wouldn't even get started before the world markets adjusted by expectations. And they would collapse their bank. It would just go like that, right from the sides in. Why would they do that when they can control other countries by buying those other countries' debts? They can own the world by selling the world cheap imports and then bringing their currencies in and then lending those countries money. You see, they're not going to do that. They're not going to do that. They're not stupid. They're Chinese. Their civilization has lived a lot longer than Western civilization, unfortunately. So, how are interest rates at that very bottom basic level being controlled? It's essentially through the actions of the central bank. The central bank of the United States essentially controls, I shouldn't say this, the real interest rate, which is that basic interest rate that's underneath all interest rates. It's actually a theoretical thing. The real interest rate, although in econometrics we can tease out a good estimate of what it is, it's not just sitting there saying, I am the real interest rate. It's kind of hidden. Underneath another interest rate. But one way or the other, you see, money on the horizontal axis, the real interest rate on the vertical axis, and you have a demand curve for money. Now, in the short run, and I'm sure you saw this in your economics class, we draw the supply curve as a very short run, perfectly inelastic animal. So here's the supply curve of money. And the equilibrium between those at any given time establishes this real interest rate. The supply and demand dynamics are about to come into play. So if the Federal Reserve wanted to bring down interest rates, let's say to stimulate the economy, it would enact what we would call expansionary money policy, monetary policy. It would bring the supply of money upward, which would, by and so doing, the real interest rate would tend to go down. That can push our interest rates. Now, historically, we have done this when we had very bad economic recessions, and then politically, it became more when we even had a little fart in the economy, they bring interest rates down. To give you an idea of how severe the real recession of 2008 was, they cranked the supply of money out so far through a series of quantitative easings. They pushed the supply of money so far out that interest rates were virtually zero. And they've been there for quite some time. Only recently has the Fed gotten scared. Because you see, if there's too much money, if the money supply is growing faster than the real growth rate of an economy, eventually you'll get inflation. Now, for a long time, that wasn't a problem. From 2009 to even fairly recently, I mean, we had a hole in the economy. I mean, it was a vast chasm. And it had been building from about 2002. And it had lots of parts to it, a lot of very bad people playing their games and bad oversight and legislation and all that. But one way or the other, I mean, the Fed printed tons and tons of money. And interestingly enough, that, of course, weakened our dollar against other currencies because our dollar wasn't as strong. And that made all kinds of problems. That, of course, made our deficits worse because then we had to offer very high interest rates on our borrowings to compensate for the fact that the foreign investors weren't getting a lot. And our foreign investors, it's not just China, Japan, Canada, Saudi Arabia. We are so dependent upon them. When you hear, well, why aren't we saying some bad things to Saudi Arabia for killing that journalist? Or why aren't we saying anything to China for its genocide against these various ethnic minorities? Why do we stay silent? Because we are their bitches, that's why. And bitch don't talk. Forgive me, this is the real world. It's not, unfortunately, the world of the Democrats and the Republicans. Now, so we'll do this again, except the opposite. When our interest rates, when the Fed contracts the money supply, that will bring the real rate up. That's where we are headed now, is essentially we're headed into higher territory because the Federal Reserve is deeply concerned about these underlying metrics that most of us aren't seeing that are warning that there is serious, serious inflation near the horizon. Well, the problem with that is, though, that when interest rates go up, when the base goes up, all interest rates are going to go up. That's going to make everything, that's going to slow down the economy. It's going to kill the economy. And a lot of people think, well, that's because people will have to borrow at higher rates, so they won't borrow as much money, they won't buy as much. Actually, that's true, but there's a much more powerful driver of a recession in a rising interest rate environment. Watch this. Project ROI. And this is so simple, but it really is the driving process. Project A, Project B, Project C. And you'll see a lot more about this as the course goes along. Project A offers 15% ROI if we take that project on. We build the factories, hire the people. Project B, we are projecting that it will have a return on investment and ROI of 10%. So if we take on Project B, we build factories, we hire people, all that. Project C offers 5% ROI. If we take on that project, we build factories, we hire workers. Good news. Okay, so right now, suppose that the cost of capital for this company is 4%. That's how much it costs for this company to get capital through selling stock, through borrowing money by issuing bonds. That's the cost of capital. Now, quite simply, ma'am, if cost of capital is 4% and Project A delivers 15% return, are we going to take Project A? Oh, yeah. Good heavens. That's a big winner. Madam, at a cost of capital of 4%, is this company going to take on Project B? Absolutely. It's a winner. And then, sir, if Project C delivers 5% and the cost of capital is 4%, will we take on Project C? Sure will. Now, what happens if the prevailing interest rate environment drives the cost of capital to 7%? We'll still take on Project A. We'll still take on Project B. But we will reject Project C because it does not cross the hurdle of cost. So, we don't build that factory. We don't hire those people. And then the Fed lifts interest rates by contracting the money supply to 11%. We'll take on Project A, but we will not take on Project B, and sure as hell not Project C. You understand what's happening here is that as the interest rates go up, it's really not about, well, people won't borrow as much money and won't buy their cars. It's really much more about the investment decision-making process. But it's even worse than that. Because the higher the expected rate of return, the greater the risk that's taken on. That's just the most solid basic principle of all finance. The more the expected return, the more risk has to be taken. So in other words, you notice that as interest rates are going up, not only is this company cutting off projects and employment, it's also shifting the portfolio of risk to higher levels. By the time we're finished, this project is essentially, I don't know, there's a term we used to use, it was in football, called the Hail Mary. By the time this is over, this company, is all it's got is its Hail Mary move. It doesn't have this balance of risk. And that is why in a recession, we start to see companies going belly up. It's because they have to take on riskier projects to cross the hurdle of cost of capital, which means that they are going to be more likely to fail. Higher risk. Yeah, higher expected return, but also a much higher risk of failure. So then it becomes essentially a a death spiral. Companies are cutting off work because the projects that they were going to hire people for just aren't economically viable. And then a bunch of those companies are going to go bankrupt because they're taking on risky projects because that's all they can take on at the high cost of capital. And then you've got more unemployment. And it becomes a death spiral. And then the Fed has to find some way to pull us out of it by lowering interest rates. But it can't do that until it has shaken out expected inflation. And there's the next part of the story. There's one and only one cause of inflation. There's only one. It is that the growth rate of the money supply exceeds the real growth rate of the economy. The growth rate of the money supply exceeds the real growth rate of the economy. No, inflation is not caused by raising the minimum wage. No, inflation is not caused by some company jacking up its prices. There is one and only one thing that can cause inflation. That's when you print too much money, and a government prints too much money. We've done it a number of times, and if we do it for too long, we get a real disaster. Because inflation is really not the problem. It's expected inflation. Because once the expectation builds in, you have to work extra hard to shake it back out. Because essentially what was happening in the 1970s is we were more or less just lying to the American people, to the investment community, saying, oh yeah, we're going to whip inflation now. That was Gerald R. Ford's way of saying, whip inflation now. They even printed up hundreds of thousands of buttons people were supposed to wear. And then Jimmy Carter came along and he said, inflation is the moral equivalent of war, M-E-O-W. Boy, that one went over really well. Meow. But unfortunately, Carter knew what really had to be done. He was an engineering major, and he got his ass kicked in the 80 election because he did what had to be done, because the inflation expectation had been built so much into investors' minds, into bankers' minds, into union minds, into company minds, that when we said, we're going to fix it now, they said, yeah, yeah, and they just kept rolling inflation expectation up. Until we nearly killed the economy to convince everyone that we were serious finally. But the reality of it was that over time, expectations of inflation, we want to get in front of them. That's why, even though we don't really see a lot of inflation yet in the economy, we see the precursors of it. And we want to get it killed before investors start putting expectations into their calculations, before bankers start putting expected inflation into their interest rates. Because you see, the first interest rates that we can see, maybe not perfectly, is what's called the risk-free rate. It doesn't have these risk premiums I'll cover on Wednesday. But the risk-free rate is that real rate of return plus an expected inflation premium. It's buried in there. It is just part of it. So it's not inflation per se that really scares us. As finance, as business people, it's expected inflation, because once that sticks in there, we have to beat the heck out of investors, bankers, unions, companies to get them to stop jacking up their prices, jacking up their interest rates, because they aren't going to trust us unless we get in front of it very fast and never, ever go back to what we did in the early in the 1970s. Well, actually, it started in the 60s. And I mean, we just kept printing money, and then inflation would go up. So we'd print more money to get everyone happy again. And then we had that OPEC oil embargo in 73, 74. And so that was going to drive us into a recession. So the Fed just prints money and gives it to everyone. Oh, don't worry about the high gasoline prices. Here's some more money. And, you know, so of course, that inflation goes up again. And by the time it was finished, we had interest rates that were really high because of this expected inflation premium. So when Carter appointed this real hardcore chairman of the Fed named Paul Volcker, he just said, we're going to crush the money supply. Well, he did, but no one believed him. Well, guess what happens when you crush the money supply? The real interest rate goes through the roof. The expected inflation was still there. So you saw interest rates, like on home mortgages, 25% interest rates. Oh, my God, the economy just dropped into a recession. Everyone was furious, blaming Jimmy Carter, the president. What kind of a horrible man are you doing this to us? Well, of course, Volcker was behind it, and he just kept his, essentially his big, he was a really tall, he's a tall man. He's a real jerk of a human being. I like him a lot. And essentially, he just kept his hand on the throat of the economy. Do you believe me? Oh, do you believe me? No. Do you believe me? Oh, yes. And finally, the expected inflation began to ease out in the early 80s. And interest rates began to settle. And Volcker then, once he knew that the markets no longer thought it'd be there, he could start expanding the money supply again and bring the real interest rate down. So the risk-free rate and all other rates began to finally settle back down in the 1982-83 period. But man, we don't want to get there again where we have that expected inflation embedding in the economy. Now, there's a graph I'm going to show you. And I'll explain it a little later because it's a conspiracy theory graph. You see, let me do a little setup. Money, as far as the fiat money, we can divide it up by liquidity. There is essentially this M1 money. That's cash and currency. Highly, highly liquid. It's what, and demand deposits at banks. In other words, checking accounts. It's sort of our basic money supply. There's actually one under M0, which is just coins and currency. M1 includes checking accounts too. And then the next one up has M1 plus some things that aren't very liquid, like certain CDs, negotiable order of withdrawal accounts, in other words, checking accounts at credit unions. It's not as liquid. So in other words, M2 has M1 in it. And then M3 is M2 plus very illiquid things, like very big CDs, giant CDs. It also has the euro dollars. Euro dollars are those dollars that are American dollars that are in foreign central banks. In other words, the Chinese People's Bank of China has trillions of euro dollars. Canada has lots of euro dollars. Saudi Arabia has lots of euro dollars. So this is sort of like the comprehensive, anything that you could call money that's associated with the U.S. government. The problem going into 2008, and why I was warning about it in the time leading up to 2008, was that the Federal Reserve had been cranking down on M1 to the point where M1 wasn't growing. Even though the economy was growing, it was almost like the lubrication of the economy, growing the money supply at the growth rate of the economy, was not keeping up. And yet, look at this M3. It was skyrocketing. That was those euro dollars. They were just flowing out of this country as we bought foreign goods. And so the overlying giant money supply was going through the roof. The Fed, it appears that the Fed was trying to control the overall money. It couldn't control euro dollars. It couldn't do anything about it. People were going to buy what they buy. But it, essentially, it choked off the you and me money, the business's money, what we use to pay wages, what we use to buy groceries. It was actually growing at zero overall. Now, a lot of people say, well, what's this big spike here? Oh, that was interesting. That was 9/11, because we were afraid at that time that people were going to freak out and rush their banks to get money out. So the Fed went on a program to just pour money into the banks in case people lost their cool after the attacks. Well, they didn't. That was bad, but they didn't run their banks, and so here's where they drained that liquidity out. They sent the trucks back out and got the money out of the banks. And so I like to say, well, that's all that's about, except there's only one problem with that official story. The attacks were on 9/11. This is July and August. This is the first days of September. You see it? Do you get it? The liquidity was being put into the banks before the attacks. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.